Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 197 with the title Beyond Sight. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome Hannah Cohen. Hannah is a visually impaired inclusion coach who empowers teams, leaders, and individuals to understand and support hidden disabilities through workshops and one-to-one coaching. And when I asked Hannah to describe her superpower, she said that it is turning lived challenge into practical inclusion. Hello, Hannah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely superb. I can almost hear you. Are you around the corner? Maybe you're not. Where are you based in the country?
Manchester.
Manchester. Wow. I'm in Portsmouth, so probably just a bit out of hearing range. So you don't sound very Mancunian.
The outskirts.
The posh bit. Posh bit.
Possibly.
Possibly. Possibly. You couldn't say. You couldn't. And I understand we're also joined by Manny.
Yes, Manny the Cavapoushon is around and about.
So we may have an interlude with a bit of yelping and a bit of... Earlier I heard the collar flicking and the ears flapping on the mic. So if we are joined by Manny, we'll welcome him most sincerely. Because news, everybody, special news, I bought myself or ourselves a Cavapoo at the weekend. So we're newly dogged up. So our dog is in the other room with my wife at the moment. So yeah, we're well into the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel poodle crossbreeds.
Yeah, and if Manny barks, maybe he'll set Amber off.
She may well join in, yeah, in which case I look forward to her being a key part of future episodes. It'll be the Joe and Amber show in future. So, she'll bring the cuteness. I'll just bring the practicalities. So, Anna, you just, as in the intro there, we talked about you're a visually impaired inclusion coach, and the authenticity in that is you are visually impaired yourself. Do you want to just explain who you are, your story, and
yeah,
a bit of background?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. So I became visually impaired around 4.5 to 5 years ago. I'm actually a solicitor and a trained solicitor. And since my sight has changed, it's been very hard to do my job. And I ended up training to become a coach. I wasn't really sure if it would be a career or not, but I thought I'd do some training to keep myself more busy. And yeah, I just sort of fell in love with it. And when I started trying to think how I could sort of niche into what direction, inclusion coaching just felt really perfect, and that I could help people who had similar challenges to me and help them navigate their way, whether it's one-to-one, people who are struggling maybe with a new diagnosis or just struggling with, you know, life, which is tough, and then going into teams and companies, helping them work out how to best work with each other and work with their clients, and then also leaders, how to work with their employees. So yeah, it works with everyone, really.
That's incredible. Even with the prevalence now of computing, tablets, text-to-speech, all these kind of tools and AI, it's still quite difficult, I guess, as a solicitor. There's lots of paper, lots of processes to follow. Different websites, different... Is that part of the challenge you faced?
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, I've spoken to loads of different solicitors in different types of law and asked, you know, to try and see how different people do it. It is possible to do it. a lot of people have support workers, and, you know, the software in my, I work in a very small firm, the software isn't very accessible. And, you know, some of the big firms, they have a lot of extra, well, as well as the money, they've got more staff, more software, different options.
Yeah, tools and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've used Access to Work. They've been relatively helpful at times, but it's really tricky. It's really tricky. And it's a different way to work. I've got to listen to documents all day in my ear.
Tiring.
It's not so, yeah, it's hard to focus on things like that. You know, you're used to sort of scanning documents with your eyes and you take the important things, and now can't do that. And it's a whole new way of learning. And I'm not sort of enjoying that. So I'm actually still working part-time as a solicitor, but I'm really hoping my inclusion work takes off, and it's, you know, I'm loving it, really enjoying it.
Yeah. I actually listened to an audiobook in the car yesterday about puppies. So my wife is a book reader. I'm not a book reader. So I bought my wife the book and I bought myself the audible version. I knew, because I was picking the puppy up and it was 3 hours each way. So I knew I had 3 hours and the book was 4.5 hours. So I started listening to it. I know exactly what you mean. The bits I would skim through, and even the audiobook sort of said, I'm going to give you the 10 points to consider in a minute. And you had to wait. I couldn't just flick ahead and recap. Yeah. So I guess you're faced with everything is very sequential now. It's hard to get a random access of the info or data you need. You're not flicking back and forwards.
No, definitely. And I do actually listen to a lot of books. But there are some that are, I think, especially learning sort of personal development books or educational books, they are meant for, you know, going into specific chapters. And yeah, it's not easy to do that. So yeah, look, it's just a new way of learning, but it can be a bit tricky.
So you describe yourself as visually impaired. To what extent has your sight failed?
So I'm actually registered blind, but I feel like if I say that I'm blind, people don't really understand, because I can see. And there is a real spectrum of blindness. I can sort of see on the screen, but you're blurry. So I don't really see detail. I can't see words. So I use a lot of tech to read stuff to me on my computer, but also on my phone. And when I'm out and about, I use my phone to read things. So luckily I can get out and about. Sort of, I can see the contrast between the pavement and the road almost 100% of the time. So, you know, I'm lucky about that. But blindness really is a spectrum. And people think people who are blind see nothing. But, you know, you never really know, you know, unless you ask. I'm very happy to be asked, but yeah, everyone's different.
There are people who've had their optic nerve fail or parts of their brain fail. Maybe that's when they get almost like the complete blindness, isn't it? Just, I'm not sure whether they see black or white or nothing or.
Well, my optic nerves have actually failed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's part of my condition. And I mean, I don't know about loads of other conditions. I don't really, you know everything, but I know that my optic nerves, I think they said they're dead, but, you know, I can see stuff. So I don't really know how it works, to be honest.
So you'd lived a good chunk of your life, and I don't want to give your age away. So you're aware of the world around you. You've got context to what you can see. So if you'd have been born this way or acquired this at a very early age, you'd have less context, so at least you know what the sky looks like, the grass looks like. So when you,
yeah,
whatever vision you have left, you can still contextualize it and get some joy from that image, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel so lucky that I still have enough sight to enjoy, you know, seeing things. I mean, it's completely different, but I love going to the beach, and I still love going to the beach, and you see it, but it's more the feeling and the noise, you know, all the senses, really. Yeah, I do feel lucky that I still have, you know, enough sight to do a lot of things.
Can you recognize people that you know still?
Yes and no. I recognize mostly the people I see all the time, but then some people I think, you know, I think I'm seeing someone and I'm not. And I do see funny things, you know, if I think I'm seeing something. I remember saying to the kids recently, what's that over there? I think we were stood outside the Apple shop in town. I said, what's that? And they said, it's a child. I went, oh, thought it was a statue. So, you know, you're not really sure sometimes what you're seeing.
What surprised you the most in society around your condition? So you said to yourself, you don't want to describe yourself as blind, you prefer visually impaired because it's blindness is misunderstood. So by saying visually impaired, you're almost implying that it's not absolute. So the people lack understanding, I guess.
I think the thing is, and also why I've put, you know, some of my works around hidden disabilities is because often in some ways, you know, it is invisible to people. Well, it always is, but in some ways that's really good because, you know, I can be in inverted commas normal, which, you know, I suppose some people with their disabilities aren't able to do that. But in a lot of ways, it makes me invisible. In other ways, as in people forget that I have it and then I feel excluded in lots of situations. But also, I always have to advocate for myself. You know, if I go into a shop and I can't find something, I have to ask people constantly. Whereas maybe if I went in with a stick, people would come up to me and ask me if they can help me. So, you know, there are pros and cons, I think, to hidden disabilities. And I think it's probably the same with every kind of hidden disability.
It's almost like you want a T-shirt that says, I have a sight impairment, visual impairment, but I'm kind of okay. Just be ready to help if I need it. But don't...
That would be perfect.
But don't patronise me and mother me.
Yeah. You know what? That is exactly right. Sometimes I just want to paint on my forehead and sometimes I don't want anyone to... You know, it is really... Yeah, it is very tricky because exactly, I don't want people to patronise me and, you know, and mother me or whatever. But at the same time, I do need help a lot of the time.
I've got a good friend of mine who was born with cerebral palsy and she has a power wheelchair and she's fearfully independent. You try and sort of mother her or manage her or do anything for her that she hasn't asked for. She'll bite her like a puppy. But being around her taught me that when I'm with her, I'll know she'll ask if she wants some help. And I'll be sitting there and she'll say, it's my round. And she'll scoot off the bar. And she'll come back with one of the bar staff in attendance carrying the drinks. So she doesn't expect us to be the bar staff. And sometimes she'll sit there and say, my shoe's fallen off. Can you put my shoe back on, please? Or when you're sitting there having a meal, she'll ask the waiter, can you please cut my food for me? Rather than ask her friends to cut the food.
Yeah,
so she's very good at advocating. But I also know that she'll just look at me and go, can you? I go, of course. But I would never offer that.
Yeah.
So it's knowing when to help, when not to help. I guess that's the same with you. You expect any people around you to be mind readers and be emotionally intelligent enough to figure out this is a Hannah moment, we need to be there.
Yeah. 100%. I mean, my friends always say they know I'm so independent and I hate having to ask for things, but I do have to sometimes. But yeah, some of the time I wish they were all psychic and just knew that I want to go to the shops and why aren't they coming to collect me now? But other times I don't want anyone to ask me and I will ask if I need it. So yeah, there's a balance, but I'm very independent. And I think that's one of the hardest things. You do feel like in some ways you've lost your independence, especially for me, stopping driving because, you know, especially having children, I can't drive them around. I have to ask other people, you know, it is difficult.
Did it come on suddenly? Was it over a period of time?
No, one eye sort of, so it's like the central vision loss. So one eye went, but I didn't really realise. It's strange. When you don't have one eye, you still see fine. So one eye went, and then I sort of mentioned it to someone, and they said, I think you should go to the optician. Anyway, you know, a few months later, the second one, and over the time I'd been to the optician, I'd been sent to a ophthalmologist, and anyway, long story short, I got admitted to hospital. They pumped me with steroids and all different things. I had like lumbar puncture, all different things. In the end, there was nothing they can do. It's a condition that it is what it is, really. It's something that triggered, which I didn't know was in me already, and that's it. There's nothing they can do. It's quite rare, but you know, over time, who knows what might be able to be done, but currently, no, nothing.
There's no equivalent to the cochlear implant for optic nerves at the moment, is there?
No, they're doing stem cell, I don't even know what it's called, but you know, but there's nothing that's actually worked as of yet. Yeah. I don't know if there's other conditions that are, you know, like ahead of it in terms of research, but yeah, who knows what the future holds.
So saying that it manifests itself as, since the central vision's failed, so you've still got some periphery.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange because I don't see, you know, to me, it just looks like I've got normal vision, but blurry. But yes, essentially, I've got peripheral vision.
So your out of focus peripheral vision is doing the seeing. So yeah, I can't see out the corner of my eye. I know there's something there, but I can't focus on it. That's kind of what you've got, and that's all you've got. So you're aware of things moving around you. So you've probably still got that reaction, have you?
Yeah, no, definitely. It is strange. I mean, I feel like sometimes I feel like I can see fine, even though I can't. Obviously, it's blurry. You know, in a small space, basically, you know, I can sort of almost tell what everything is and who everyone is. And as soon as it's slightly further away, that's when there's more of a struggle. But yeah, like if my son's in his room, in a room with his friends, I can't tell which one's which. But, you know, so, yeah.
You just got four or five blobs of humanity, little human.
Basically, they all look similar. I mean, if one's blonde and one's brown, I can tell. But otherwise, they're all just teenage boys who smell.
Yeah, you're mine.
Exactly.
I can imagine that you put them in special coloured T-shirts and colour code them like jockeys or something, so you could tell.
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
You say you got boys and you got family, and how have they adjusted to you?
So, well, actually, I became a widow 7.5 years ago.
Sorry.
So, no, thank you. So, it's just me and my two kids, my teenage son, who is almost 17, nearly learning to drive, and my daughter, who's 19, who's just gone to university. So, it was a struggle because I was their sole parent looking after them, and then they had to sort of take on more responsibilities. And, you know, I didn't ever want them to look after me, and I didn't need looking after, but it was a journey and we've been through a lot, but now we're, you know, they're amazing and they're more resilient because of it. And like my daughter at uni, she's not struggled at all in terms of independence because she's used to being independent and used to doing stuff for herself. So I suppose there's pros and cons, but yeah, the kids are brilliant and all my friends and family have been amazing help.
So that creates a problem in the future as well, doesn't it? So you want to ensure your children have their lives, they're not encumbered by you, for want of a better way, you know, not burdened by you. And say, if you want to go to uni, you want to go off to live your life. I fully understand that. That must be a daunting prospect for you.
Yeah, well, it's very strange having my daughter away. And once my son goes to university, which he says he wants to, I mean, that will be very odd. My daughter is very helpful tech-wise. Mm. My son's not so techy. So I'm trying to learn to do more tech things that I would normally just say, oh, can you just help me? Because it's quicker. But I'm learning to do more on my own because she's not here. But yeah, I mean, the thought of them both not being here is very strange. I'm okay without them. But sometimes you sort of rely on people around you just for the little jobs, just to save time.
Yeah. So you've got your Amazon wish list set up. You've got your Tesco's online ordering. You can do all that. And
exactly.
And when they deliver, they'll put it in the cupboard for you if you ask these days, won't they? So.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as long as they bring it in for me, and sometimes I'll say, oh, what's this? You know, and they'll say, well, you ordered that, didn't you? But
that's when you need the T-shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm visually impaired, not stupid. Please help.
The problem is that I don't, you know, if someone is dropping my shopping off, I don't like to tell them I'm visually impaired, which is, you know, they're coming in my house. I don't know who they are, really. I do feel a bit vulnerable sometimes. So
yeah.
I don't actually, I don't know, you know, if that's necessarily the right thing, but that's how, you know, I feel safer that way.
It's an interesting point, I suppose. Yeah, you're by being vulnerable, it makes you vulnerable.
Exactly. Yeah, I, you know, I do feel a bit more vulnerable in certain situations, which I didn't before. But, you know, I'm sort of, you know, you get used to it, really.
You get anxious when you're out alone?
Sometimes, yeah. You know, I take the dog out every day on my own. And I know, you know, I know the area, I know where I'm going, and I can see the contrast of the pavements. But sometimes, you know, if I have to cross a small road, and I can pretty much tell if a car's coming. But occasionally a car just turns up. I'm like, oh my God, you know, and things like that. And I notice when I'm walking, I am more anxious than I used to be because I do have to take more care and I have to be, you know, more aware really. Oh yeah. But, you know, I love getting out as well. So it's, I think I also am very anxious, not intentionally, but when I'm in shops, because there's just, it's just a bit of a stressful situation being in a place where you don't, can't really see anything. And also there's lots of people around. Who are they? Do I know them? Do they know me? You know, it's strange.
I mean, I don't know why I'm saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. As you're talking there, it's a bit like being in a strange hotel and needing the loo in the middle of the night and there's no lights on. And you know the bathroom's around here somewhere, and you can just about see something, but you don't realise that the doorstop is just there, and you end up kicking it or something, or hopes you bang your head on something. And you think, what's that? Oh, that was the hairdryer.
Yes, all the time.
Yeah.
Actually, recently I was away for a few days, and I came back, and I was in bed, and I got up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet, and I just did not, you know, when you don't know where you are.
Yeah.
But then because I couldn't really see, I was so confused where I was walking. But, you know, I suppose it happens to everyone. In the dark, most people can't see much anyway. No. So.
But, yeah, if this is invasive, is your sight going to deteriorate more over time, or has it got to the worst?
It took a bit of time actually to settle. It did take at least a year and a half, maybe longer, to feel like I knew where it was and where I could go and how I felt. It took quite a while, but I don't think it's going to deteriorate. But because it's a rare condition, you never really know, but hopefully not.
So you had, I think it's just reading into what you're just saying, it wasn't overnight. It grew or failed over the course of time. So you had a chance to adjust. In some respects,
sort of. I mean, overnight I couldn't drive, but it almost went worse. It almost was worse, and then it got better. I don't know if it was bad or if I needed to get used to it for it to settle. If that makes sense, I don't know if it was in my mind because of the stress and the anxiety. If that made it so much worse, because it's such a massive shock. So yeah, I don't know really. You know, I was never really told at the hospital. You know, it's this level and then it's this level. Because people do say to me, oh, what number are you? I'm minus whatever. I say, I actually have no idea. And I do wear glasses, and I wore glasses before. They're exactly the same glasses, and they stop me getting eye strain, but they don't make me see different.
No, because it's not a focusing issue. It's not a lens issue. It's just,
no, I think no I had a stigma. I don't know if that makes a difference now. As in, I don't know if that's still there. I've no idea. I'm not very good with medical stuff, but all I know is they help. With eye strain, so I just put them on when I'm staring at a screen or it's the front door.
There goes Manny. Manny's going Manny. Yeah. Just let her know. Answer the front door. We're okay. We're all cool with this. We've done it before, haven't we, listeners?
Oh.
Well, it's a sign of your resilience that the doorbell rings and you still go up and answer it. Yeah, you still got to live your life, haven't you? You can't just say,
exactly,
I'm visually impaired. I can't. It could do.
No.
Life's got to happen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people say to me all the time, you're so resilient. But I just feel like you either live your life or you don't. And I live my life.
Yeah.
I don't feel resilient. I feel like I've just got to do and live.
Do you get the, you're brave?
All the time.
Yeah, you get brave. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Do you get that as well?
Yeah, I get brave sometimes. Yeah. Not so much these days. But yeah. Brave. Or my wife, Marie, gets brave as well because we've been married 38 years. So she's had to cope with a fair bit of flack for me. So, yeah, it's, I always think about it when you're not actually brave at the time. So you may look over your shoulder and go, oh, wow, maybe I was a bit. But when you're dealing with it, you're just dealing with it, aren't you, in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't make a decision, oh, I'm going to be really brave and resilient and get out of bed today or anything. It's like, well, I either get out of bed or I...
Well, you don't.
Yeah.
You're exactly. A wallow.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't get breakfast if you stay in bed unless your children are feeling like it. Manny's going to go angry.
Yes, exactly.
And the delivery driver will be at the door knocking on saying, take your parcel. You have just got to get on with things, haven't you? And you can't can't hide from the world as much sometimes you want to have a duvet day, I suppose.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, look, life's hard and lots of people have struggles of all different types, but you just have to try and get on with it and live your best life. You know, I'm not saying that my life every day is a happy, perfect day, but overall, it's good.
So you work with teams, leaders in businesses, individuals as well. What do they often come to you to talk about? What's the thing they cover?
So the teams, you know, and the leaders, well, the teams are more, you know, the company gets me in. So then, you know, it's sort of less of a choice for them, but it's amazing speaking to them and working with them in their workshops, because some of them are just so unaware about a lot of hidden disabilities, and they just, it feels like they're learning loads, which I just love. I love helping people to understand other people and understand why they might have acted like that. One person said in a workshop, right, my brother's neurodiverse. I always just call him really annoying because he drives me mad. But now I actually understand that he's struggling and I'll be nicer to him. And I, you know, things like that are really great to hear people say. And then the leaders, you know, a lot of leaders struggle working with their employees, you know, whether it's neurodiversity or people with medical conditions that are classed as hidden disabilities or mental illness, you know. And a lot of it is just letting them know that it's okay to just ask people, what do you need to be able to do the job? Or, you know, how can I help you? Often these questions are all people want. And, you know, people get so worried about knowing what to say but, you know, often it's just ask people, how can you help them? And that makes a massive difference.
Yeah, because you are your own best advocate, aren't you? You know what you need. And if you're not sure, just say, what can I do to make your life easier right now? Tell me.
Exactly.
It's not a daft question.
It's not. And it makes a massive difference, especially in companies, you know, for their employees. They just want to feel like, they want to feel understood and valued. You know, one-to-one coaching is different. It's, you know, I do it in the companies, but out as well. And that's more for people who might have hidden disabilities and they're struggling to cope in certain situations or in work. And also people whose maybe children have been diagnosed with neurodiversity and they're struggling to deal with them, or they're realizing that they are neurodiverse all of a sudden after getting their kids diagnosed, and they're realizing they actually must have it. And, oh, that's why my life's been like this for 30, 40 years. So there's so many different things around hidden disabilities that I just find really interesting and want to help people and, you know, work with people.
In your experience, when you're working with other people, maybe with hidden disabilities as well, do they have a very similar outlook as yourself on this? I don't always want to share it, and sometimes I need to, and sometimes I don't want to. It's when relevant, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, I think some people are different. Some people want people to know all the time. You know, some people might wear a lanyard or a badge.
Well, and other people don't. Yeah.
And some people don't want people to know at all. So it can be quite varied. Yeah, I feel like I'm generally very happy to just talk about it and tell people. Whereas, you know, other people I know with different disabilities are much more reserved. Well, not reserved, but, you know, they just don't like anyone to know. And they're just, yeah, it's maybe more private.
Well, I've got friends who are neurodiverse, neurospicy, some of them, whatever language they use to describe themselves.
Yeah.
And some of them will start every sentence with, my ADHD, you know. Sort of, it's almost like everything revolves around their ADHD or their autistic traits or whatever it may be. And there are other people who are arguably undiagnosed but exhibit the characteristics of someone with ADHD or autism, AUSD.
They
just get on with life, and it's different, isn't it? I mean, people have told me I've got a level of neurodiversity. I don't need to be diagnosed. I'm quite cool with it. Certainly not the characteristic I'm worried about. I've got other things going on in my life. I don't need another diagnosis.
Yeah.
You recognize the traits in different people, but some people need that diagnosis, don't they? They need that part of their identity. You might say, I am blind as an adjective, as a an identity describer, because it gives you a sense of community and understanding and recognition. Or you might just say, actually, I just don't see as well as I used to. I'm fine.
Yeah. No, definitely. You know, I mean, I can work with people who don't have diagnosis and vice versa, but just everyone is so different. And yeah, some people really want everyone to know. They want to shout it. You know, this is almost, sometimes I feel like some people just need it. It's like, this is me. This is why I've been like this. And, you know, and other people just, you know, it's irrelevant. They just get on. This is me. Doesn't matter what I am.
Give me the meds. You know? I need them. If not, don't worry about it.
Yeah, exactly.
No, yeah, I'm with you. You're right. We're a mixed bag of humanity. We're all going to respond to different situations differently. And yeah, but some people need that sense of belonging, that community, to feel maybe safer, maybe feel more empowered as a result of it.
Yeah, yeah. I just try to help people understand their strengths and use their own strengths, whatever they are. You know, we all have our own strengths. And as long as you can harness them, you know, you'll get where you want to go.
Yeah. You mentioned right at the beginning about the struggle that your workplace, a small employer, small practice, to what extent should your employer have invested more in you? I mean, because think about the Equality Act.
Yeah.
Access to work, all those sort of schemes. It's, did they do the minimum or is it just, they just didn't have the resources?
I think it's a mix of things. I think they don't have the resources. They don't. Sorry, that was Alexa. She thought she'd get involved as well. I don't think they've got the resources. I don't think they really knew what to do. I think, you know, this was the first time anything like this had happened to them as well as me. They've been very, very supportive, like sort of mentally, if that makes sense. But in terms of the work stuff, I've sort of got on with it myself a bit. I had to, you know, speak to Access to Work and get things inputted and stuff. You know, I think there are pros and cons being in, say, in the firm or in the position I've been in the office, as in everyone's so loving and welcoming. When I was off sick with, you know, I took about a year off because, you know, I had to sort of just get to grips with my new reality. You know, they'd come and visit and always, they were always looking out for me. So, you know, other people might have been in a different situation when they had all the software, but no one actually speaking to them in, you know, were looking out for them. So I don't know exactly really, but yeah, it's been tricky.
I guess also, I mean, just listen to your story about your career change and all pivot, which I wish you would describe it. Your outlook on life also changed. So maybe you lost the passion to be a solicitor and do what you were doing. So even if they'd been the perfect employer and put all these tools in place, your brain was being exhausted by the new reality of having to process information in a sequential audio format. So your own expectations about what you wanted to do changed as well, didn't they?
Definitely. And, you know, I just feel so passionate about the inclusion work. You know, I'm really enjoying it. And the more I learn about it, the more I talk to people, the more I just want to be doing it all the time. And I'm not sure I ever really felt like that about law, to be honest.
My background
is
in IT.
It was more of like a means to an end. Oh, really?
I spent 20, 25 years in either in electronics or IT. And then I discovered people. And it was like, wow, this is far more enjoyable. I get engaged with empathy, compassion. Yeah, my life is so much more enriched in the last 10 years than it ever was. I'm not saying I had a bad life.
Yeah.
I've opened a box and found a whole new treasure. And it sounds like you found the same.
No, definitely. I feel like I'm almost like blossoming into myself, and I'm learning about myself as well as the world, people, everything. Yeah, I feel definitely enriched.
I've got friends who talk to me about the social model of disability as opposed to the medical model. And the key thing is, it's society that is disabling. Society doesn't enable you. And you're probably hyper aware of that yourself now, about these unseen barriers. And I think it doesn't mean people are bad people. They're just wearing blinkers and they see the world through their own lens. They don't see the world through your eyes. Therefore, they don't understand what it means to be think about your needs. Everyone's so busy focusing on what they want.
Yeah. No, 100%. Look, the world has been designed for, I mean, there's say able-bodied, but, you know, that term isn't always accepted. But yeah, the typical, because even for neurodiverse people, the workplace isn't built for them. You know, there's just so much that I think over the next, I don't know how long, 10, 20, 30 years, things are going to change massively to make sure that either everyone gets what they need separately, or the world is built in a bit more of a more open way to serve more people, really.
I spend a lot of time with my mum. She's, 86, and she needs to use a rollator now. She struggles to walk. She ends up with back pain if she walks too far without the rollator. Like I was talking about my friend who has cerebral palsy in a wheelchair, until you've spent a day or two or a lot longer with these people, you don't realise how inconvenient the world is for them. Stuff that I take for granted. You know, I remember going to London with my friend and just getting on and off the train, finding the underground was just a huge sojourn around trying to navigate different lifts, all this and curbstones and buses. I took my mum to Edinburgh back in the spring and we booked passenger assistance and it was a bit hit and miss. It wasn't great. You know, you felt like you were having to try to figure it out on your own. And on the way back, first class, we were traveling first class on the train. We turned up at the first class lounge and said, oh, my mum's booked passenger assistance. Have you checked in with passenger assistance downstairs? No, I haven't. Can you deal with that for me? My mum is 86. She's just about made it here. Oh, okay. And then all of a sudden this person was running around the lounge shouting at this person's name. I thought, well, that's not my mum. Okay. I just sit here. I look at my watch thinking, our train's leaving in about 15 minutes and I know how far it is from the first class lounge at Edinburgh to the first class carriages on the platform. I said, look, my mum, she says, your mum this? I said, no, that's not my mum's name. Well, you're sure it's not your mum's name? I said, I'm very sure it's not my mum's name. What a silly question. And eventually I got the person at the desk to run off and then she disappeared. I was now faced with nobody with a radio.
Oh, my God.
And I managed to grab something and said, look, your person here has gone off to check something and we're now 5 minutes before the train departs. We are not going to be happy if we miss our train and my mum cannot run. Okay. And I know you don't want to hold the train up. So what are we going to do here? Eventually, she says, I will take you now. And we frog marched from the first class lounge down the
God.
In this train. And by the time we got there, it was like my mum was, I was struggling. We get on the train and they take my mum's rollator, they stick it in the luggage rack, which then probably falls off and hits somebody else. And I wrote, we and my friend ChatGPT, we wrote a little complaint letter because our train on the way up was 45 minutes, no, an hour late, I think it was, on arrival. They cancelled the train we booked on. The next one we could get was 2 hours later, so we're automatically entitled to a refund on the journey up. So I wrote a complaint letter about this passenger assistance and how all this played up. And so we got the return back free as well. So two of us was on the way back, £400 worth of first class return ticket to Edinburgh. We got free.
Wow, I mean, amazing.
It doesn't compensate for the poor experience.
Mm.
But me and my mum did laugh and sort of wink at each other, going, well, it wasn't so bad after, really, was it? It could have been worse. We could have missed the train.
Yeah.
My mum could have been on her own. I mean, she's feisty. She could have self-advocated, but she probably wouldn't have wanted to in the same forceful way I was able to. You must find that yourself. You know, things.
Yeah.
You find yourself having to complain and get angry more than you really want to.
Yeah. I think overall with things like passenger assistance and the ones at the airport, overall I've had good experiences. I think the times I've not had good experiences is when I'm trying to do it myself in a way. But it is hard because you've got to rely on these people. If they don't pick you up, like, you know, from the lounge and take you where you want to go, you're not going anywhere, are you? A few weeks ago, I was in London and I was staying at my sister-in-law's and I wanted to go to a conference in Wembley, a coaching conference. I thought, well, okay, I can manage to get from there to there and then I'll ask someone. but it was a lot harder than I thought it would be. And I could have booked some sort of assistance, at least some of it, but I didn't, because I thought, well, I'll just ask. But it was quite hard, and it was quite stressful. And it just made me realise that maybe I can't do some things on my own that I want to do or thought I could. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think there's apps probably that I don't know about that, you know, it's like navigating apps that I've never tried that I need to look into, because that was the first time that I tried to navigate myself from one place to another.
Yeah.
And I realised that Google Maps does not do that for me these days. So I think there are others out there. I just have never tried them.
City Map, if it's in London or any major city, City Map is a good app.
That one's not accessible either. It's about it sort of being really accessible and then reading to me where, you know, you're in this direction, go that way. City Mapper, I'm not sure. I don't think that was accessible when I was in London. I did try it, I think. Google Maps was telling me where to go. I just couldn't work out where it was telling me. It was like, go down this road. I'm like, well, I don't know which road that is. You know, I need one that says, go straight ahead, you know, works out where I'm going, sort of thing.
Yeah, I would have thought City Mapper had done that. It would have said, bus stop, get on the 76 in 2, 5, or 10 minutes or something. It would tell you the bus is.
I don't know. I'm sure I tried to click on it to try and work something out, and the buttons just said button rather than, you know, that sort of thing.
So the interface wasn't intuitive, yeah.
Yeah, often interfaces don't work with a voiceover or different screen reader tech.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, yeah. And websites, I guess. Do you get annoyed with the lack of alt text and visual descriptions and things?
Yeah, I used to love shopping. I mean, I still love shopping, that's a lie, but it's so much more difficult now. Unless there's good descriptions on things, it's impossible. I mean, I've ordered things before and they've turned up and they haven't been what I expected. They've been the colour, and it, you know, I know it's a brown top, but it's got all this detail that I didn't know it had, and I wouldn't have ordered it, you know, so it's really frustrating. Really frustrating. There's so much that isn't accessible that you don't realize until you're using some, like, you know, accessible screen reader technology type of thing. You just don't know. I mean, I didn't know any of this even existed really before my site changed. So it's amazing what is out there, but it's very frustrating how little is accessible as well.
It's getting better, isn't it? It is getting better. I look at Apple technologies and Microsoft technologies, it is built into the core of the platform these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I use all Apple stuff and I think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
But yeah, some websites just very, very hard to use.
So can you still put mascara on?
Yes and no. I do it, you know, by sort of feel. Occasionally, you know, I'll get it in my eye or on my face, or I'll come downstairs and my daughter will go, you've got makeup all down here on your cheek. But generally people say to me, oh, your makeup's nice. Who did it? I did. But I don't know what it looks like, but apparently it looks good.
And why not?
Exactly. I mean, you know, there are pros and cons. I don't look wrinkly and I don't think I ever will, to me.
No, you'll always be the age you were.
Yeah, exactly.
So you now go to the hairdresser and say, just make it look fabulous.
Well, actually, I told my hairdresser to tell me when I was grey enough to need some colour doing. And she said, you've got some greys. I don't think you need it doing yet, but I think you might want to do it. As in, you might, if you could see, you would probably want it done. So she picked some out and put a bit of colour on. But, you know, I'm paying for all this stuff that I can't even see. It seems a bit mad, but, you know.
That's the beauty industry, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm definitely not bought into so much stuff because I think, well, you know, I can't see what I'd be using it for. But a lot of my friends are into all different things. You know, there's so many amazing products out there now, or gadgets.
Has it changed your relationship with food? Because a lot of food is smell and sight, isn't it? You know, you go into a restaurant and the menu, the appetizer, you know, you're looking at the menu, the visual colours and it's all that marketing first. So you must largely go for something you've had before? Do you fall for it?
No, I don't think so. The one thing which is actually quite funny is, you know, like if you see a dessert, you think, oh, I really want that. Well, I don't really get that because I can't see it. So that actually it helps quite a bit. But in terms of, you know, on a menu, I mean, it's a pain. You know, I normally ask someone who I'm with to read the menu to me. And, you know, someone's reading it and like, oh, can you stop that? Oh, can you read that again? I missed that. And by the end, they're fed up and I can't be bothered listening anymore. So I just picked something that I've spent more time thinking over things and looking at the menu and, you know, but I don't think majorly affects food. I mean, it affects what I make at home because I've got like, you know, jars of spices. Well, I can't be bothered spending time with my phone trying to work out which one's which. I just make something that I make all the time, really.
I guess the salad bar at Harvester, you need help with these days as well.
Pardon, sorry?
The salad bar at Harvester.
God, yeah, that's impossible. Anything like that is impossible.
I reckon that's sweet corn. That's probably kidney beans. That's probably a bit of beetroot.
Yeah, exactly. And we did actually go to a hotel with some family a while ago, and they have to literally go around with me and say, right, this is this and this is this. So it's, anyway. It's not that much fun.
15 or so years ago, I was at a restaurant. They were hosting this, I think it was a 5 or 6 course set meal called, I think they called it the Around the World Night. So you had a different dish. They sold the restaurant seats out. So you couldn't just turn up. So they booked the whole restaurant out and you had to book the 5 or 6 courses. And you just sit there and they just serve you the next course. And on the table next to, the friend I was with and I, she was blind, visually impaired, whatever description you'd like to use, but she clearly couldn't see. And she was feeling in the cutlery, feeling the plate, you know, starting to eat. And what she didn't see was a really hot, large chili on top of the meal. Of course, everyone's plate looked the same. Mine arrived in front of me, my friend's arrived in front of his. We looked down, and clearly we could see a nasty, high power chili. It wasn't I think we made him a firecracker or one of those really ones you get in the Gerald Frazee's type meal. And she just chewed into it. And of course, she had no forewarning about this heat explosion in her mouth. And she was completely distraught, completely shocked and she felt violated. She'd been attacked by this chili. This pain came out of nowhere. And
yeah, that's horrible.
And it made me realize that, you know, when you think about accessibility, popping a chili or popping something on a bit of food, you've got a lot of responsibility there to say to the people as you put it down, be careful, this is hot. The plate's hot, the pan's hot, and there's a chili on top. And I think we have to audio describe for our restaurant goers as well. And it sounds 100%. Like that could have happened to you in this scenario.
Definitely. I mean, I have, you know, taken a massive, you know, when sometimes they put one of those massive chunks of parsley on top of something, just a big tree. And I've gone in and I'm like, oh, what's that? But luckily it wasn't a chili. But I have, I can't remember why. I don't know if it was decorative or what, but, you know, taking a big piece of lemon in my mouth, like a wedge of lemon that was in something. I'm like, oh, what's that? You know, things like that that don't need to be there or should be on the side or explain. But often I'll say to people, if I'm sat with someone, which I generally am when I'm in a restaurant, where, you know, I ask them to sort of point out where everything is or what it is on the plate. If I know there's a selection of things and say, you know, which one the potatoes, which one's the, just so I've got, especially if, it, you know, if you order something like white fish and then the plate's white and then the potatoes are white and you're like, I can't, it's just all one colour.
Just plate.
Yeah, exactly.
You need sort of like audio captions live for the real world as well, don't you?
Exactly. I mean, that would be perfect. But so often my companion, whoever it may be, is my audio describer. And I always say to the kids as well, if we're walking out and about, I say, you know, make sure you tell me who, you know, if we see someone and they just come up to me and go, hi, Hannah, who is it? And often I'll just say to someone's face, who are you? You know, because I've given up being polite.
I mean, we've been having a conversation now for, 55 minutes, and a lot of what we're talking about is your real-life experience of being not included. I'm not saying you've been excluded, but you haven't been consciously included. So you're having to do more self-advocacy than you would you feel you should have to, because the world is still assuming the normality of, you know, that 80% of people who are in the middle of there somewhere.
Yeah.
I think you've highlighted some things that I hadn't considered before about what we as individuals need to do, we as business need to do, we as colleagues, whatever it may be, just to be more consciously inclusive, not just of visual impairment, hearing, other sensory perceptions, neurodiversity, whatever it may be, because it could happen to us. When yeah. it's us, we'll lose our hearing at some point in our life. I'm not sure what the stats are for sight, but certainly one in six for hearing.
I don't know what the stats are for sight, but there are some stats about how many people will become disabled by the time they're, you know, whether it's 60, 70, 80 age. You know, most people will become disabled of some sort in their lifespan. And yeah, you know, you don't know what someone's going through, even if you don't know they're visually impaired or they're neurodiverse. You know, maybe they're just having a horrendous day. And they just need a bit more compassion.
All four of our parents went through a phase where they needed a blue badge. Yeah, so that's four out of four at around mid-80s years old. So at some point, it's pretty certain that you're either going to have hearing, sight, or physical. My wife just had a total knee replacement. And this is the crazy thing about the Equality Act. Is that a disability is only classed a disability if it persists for over a year. So the fact that my wife's had a total knee replacement, she's not entitled to any support, blue badge, anything like that, because it's a transient condition and not more than a year.
Right.
You think, well, hang on a minute, she can't walk from the car to the car park. She's got no entitlement to use a disabled spot, pay for parking, whatever it may be. And we've got to think about those people who maybe don't quite hit the threshold, and how are they supported as well?
Yeah, definitely.
And you know, you could lose your sight or your hearing to a point where you are disabled by most definitions, but not disabled enough to qualify for support. And it's
no, definitely.
And even if you do, hoops you have to jump. You've been through access to work, and any benefits you get, you have to be brutally kind of assessed as to. You sure you can't work? You sure you can't provide that for yourself? Show us your budget. Show us your money. Show us our father-in-law. He's just come out of hospital, broke two ribs. They thought he was going to die at one point. They sent him home. And he said, well, what support can we get? Well, he's not broken enough. You know, he's recovered. It's like, yeah, but if you don't help him, he'll fall over and he'll be back in hospital and he'll be back where we started. Well, we're not set up for that. We're set to fix what we can see. Not prevent what might.
Yeah. No, I know. And you mentioned conscious inclusion. That's something that I speak about in my workshops, because it's not about consciously excluding people. It's just about consciously including everyone. So, you know, it doesn't matter what anyone's got or what they're going through, or if they've got a diagnosis or if they're disabled or not really. It's about making sure everyone has what they need.
Yeah. I always remember the story about there was a person who got off an aeroplane, I think it was at one of the London airports, and he had his own custom wheelchair. And for whatever reason, that custom wheelchair wasn't made available at the gate when he got off the plane. And they offered to push him through the terminal in a one with a handle on the back. And he refused and said, I would rather drag myself on my knuckles through the terminal on the floor than have you push me in a wheelchair, because that will make me disabled. You've taken away my autonomy. You've taken away my advocacy. You basically said, I am disabled. I am not. I can do this myself. And I always use that as an example of how badly did that go. The gate staff could have handled that in such a different way, where this person would have felt validated, listened to, considered, supported. They would not have escalated, but instead they say, here's a chair, get in it. That's your only option. And there was another one, wasn't it? The COP26 was the climate in Edinburgh or Glasgow, where one of the delegates was a wheelchair user and she couldn't get access to the venue on the first day. She turned up and they said the entrance wasn't accessible. There wasn't a plan B. You think, well, hang on a minute. This is basic stuff. Basic stuff.
Yeah.
If your plan A fails, what's your plan B? C. D, E, F, G, all the way through to Z or Z, 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 Z. Keep coming up with plans. What I always say to people, the first plan B is listen and ask the person, what could you do instead?
Yeah, they'll exactly. tell
you. And then you can base your future plans on an individual.
No, 100%.
Too often we just job's worth or there's lack of empowerment, lack of whatever it may be. Mm. And I'm sorry, we can't do that. I bet if I got angry with the right person, you'd make it happen.
Yeah.
Cut out the angry bit and just get the right person.
Exactly, because it's exhausting. You don't want to have to get angry every time just to get what you need.
I know. But you almost know you're going to have to, though, don't you? That's the sad thing. Hannah, it's been fascinating chatting to you. I can't believe we've been rabbiting on now for nearly an hour and a half. Bit in the green, bit here.
So. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Your story is incredible, and I'm not going to use the brave or all those other words you have. You've got some true grit there, and I think what's come out of your adversity is you've discovered yourself, and you found a passion, you found something that's going to drive you, and you're changing the world in your own way.
Thank you.
It's fabulous.
Well, I hope so. Thanks.
How can people get hold of you? What's the best way of tracking you down?
Well, I'm on most of the social media sites. My business is called The Insight Coach. So you'll find me on LinkedIn. Well, my name, Hannah Cohen, on LinkedIn, The Insight Coach on Instagram and Facebook, and my website, theinsightcoach.com.
So Hannah, just for accessibility, is HANNAH and Cohen, COHEN. Is that right?
Yeah, brilliant.
Cool. Find you on LinkedIn. And obviously, if someone's contacting you, be aware you're using a screen reader.
Yeah.
Make it concise, make it easy.
Yeah. And images.
And put some alt text on the images if you're going to put them there.
Yeah, exactly. People sometimes just send me an image and that's it. I'm like, well, great.
Yeah. What's that? White fish on a white plate with potatoes, isn't that? That should be the title of the episode. White fish, white potatoes. With a bit of lemon.
Yeah, a big wedge of lemon.
Hannah, thank you.
Great. Thanks, Joe.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.